Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Throughout these podcast episodes, we will speak to a range of individuals about their experience of eating disorders, with the aim of increasing awareness and understanding whilst reducing stigma and isolation. Please note that the topics discussed in this podcast may be triggering for some individuals, so tread lightly, check in with yourself, and reflect on these conversations. In this week's episode, I'm joined by Leslie and Neil Davison. In 2017, their 27-year-old daughter, Megan, took her own life as a result of a long struggle with Tide, a deadly combination of food and insulin restriction. Since her death, Leslie and Neil have campaigned on all platforms to raise awareness of Tide and have successfully carried out a legal challenge to the outcome of Megan's original inquest. This podcast is so important to listen to understand the importance of different healthcare teams working together to provide continuous care. Particularly in the case of diabetes and eating disorders, it is so important as often the treatment for one can contradict the other. This is a message to all healthcare professionals that are working with people who have eating disorders and different comorbidities. It is essential to work across teams with different healthcare professionals. I will just say that this episode does mention suicide, and so I just wanted to put the trigger warning there for anybody if that's a difficult conversation to hear right now. Thank you so much to Leslie and Neil for sharing Megan's story. It really was an honour to have you on the podcast. Well, Leslie and Neil, it is so lovely to have you on the podcast. Thank you so much for joining me. How are you doing today?
You're welcome, and we're both fine.
Yeah, looking forward to it.
Looking forward to chatting.
Yes, absolutely. Me too. When I first heard you guys speak, I think it was at one of the APPG meetings on Zoom, I think. And I was very touched by your story. So I'm really honoured to have you both here today. Would you like to introduce yourself to the listeners?
Well, I'm Leslie Davison, and I'm Megan's mum. And it's Megan that we're going to be talking about today.
Yeah, I'm Neil, obviously husband of Leslie and father of two daughters originally, but obviously we lost Megan in 2017, and since then we've been trying to honour her wishes and help the people that she's left behind dealing with this particular condition.
Yeah, amazing. Well, thank you so much, and honestly, I'm, you know, very honoured to have you on to share your story. I guess to start with, in your words, would you like to share Megan's story?
Well, a very bright, articulate young girl. We've always said she wasn't anybody's sparkly princess. She wasn't anybody's ray of sunshine, but you did know she'd entered a room. She was more like a tornado than a rainbow. And, you know, she was a very determined person. And I think that made her particularly difficult to help. Because she was very independent and she didn't really want anybody to know anything much about her. She did all the things you're supposed to do. She got her A levels. She got her degree in psychology. She always wanted to be a teacher. Neil's family is a family of teachers, and Megan very much wanted to be part of that. And she'd seen how good teachers work, and I think that sort of inspired her. So unfortunately, she was quite ill. We didn't know. We thought she had glandular fever. So she was quite ill, which meant she had to take a break in university and doing a PGCE. But she worked through that year and then went to Harts Uni and got her PGCE and was taken up as a primary school teacher by the first school that she went to during her PGCE year, and was absolutely adored by the people at that school. So I think that's sort of a brief overview of what the outside world saw since she's told us, or she told us in her letter that she left us, that she felt she'd had disordered eating since her early teens. Not something that we'd particularly picked on, because she'd always been quite a fussy, picky eater. And very determined. If she said she didn't want something, she didn't want it. And it was a case of working around it. And then she got diagnosed with type 1 at 16. And the people that did the diagnosis said, well, you're 16. you seem quite a bright girl. Would you like to be treated as a child or an adult? And obviously she chose adult, what teenager wouldn't. And that was it then. We were persona non grata as far as the medical profession was concerned. We were just held behind a wall of confidentiality for the next 10 years. And so, I mean, that's pretty much where we started. Do you want to?
Well, yeah, I mean, just on that basis, I mean, Megan had led a relatively surreptitious life with regard to telling people what was going on with her health, and her suicide letter contained information of her journey through life, probably 90-95% of which we just didn't know anything about. It's weird to say it, but only 3 days after her first suicide attempt were we aware that she was even struggling. And she was, like Leslie says, she was ticking all the boxes as parents. She was independent. She knew her own mind. She was living on her own. She had a boyfriend. She was doing her dream job. So from the outside looking in, you know, it wasn't something we were getting involved. And weirdly, a lot of the sort of symptoms of this condition reflect what goes on through adolescence anyway, where somebody becomes isolated and somebody doesn't, you know, want to tell you what's going on. They spend hours in the loo and things of that nature, which we didn't necessarily pick up on at the time, but retrospectively now we can possibly pick up what was going on. So what happened at the age of 16? She carried on what she expressed as eating disorder behaviours, and it transitioned into not being honest about how she was handling her insulin. So both food and insulin restriction were going on at that stage, and she spent 10 years mismanaging her insulin, which eventually led into, luckily, a curious dietitian who picked up on the word diabulimia, just luckily, and referred Megan to Trust Services to treat that particular condition and clinical depression at the time as well. So she was spiraling out of control. And I say fortunately, luckily she pulled through her first attempt at taking her own life and therefore was subject to the next 11 months treatment of both community and inpatient services to treat her condition, neither of which, as far as she was concerned, were productive enough for her to not stop spiraling out of control. So things got progressively worse, and Megan even left this information in her letter, picking up on what she thought was missing from the treatment that she was receiving. And we've been running with that ever since.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for sharing that. I think one thing that I can't really get my head around is you mentioned about kind of, you know, Megan got the support and was treated like an adult, which firstly, I don't think a 16-year-old should be asked that, because as you said, what 16-year-old is going to say, oh no, please treat me like a child. I want independence. That's what we all crave when we're a 16-year-old. But so you mentioned like the misuse of insulin. Was that not picked up for multiple years before the dietitian suggested something? Because to me, that surely would be part of, you know, diabetes management, working with the diabetes team.
I mean, to be fair, this is all going back. Megan's first, so you've got 2006 to 2016. We have since got hold of Megan's records because we needed that. And the only time her diabetes was sort of under control was her first clinic visit after diagnosis. So literally for the next 10 years, it was, you've got to do better, Megan. You know, this is wrong, that's wrong, you're just not doing it right. And to be fair to the people at that time, I'm not sure if anybody had picked up on it, they would have known what to do with her, because they didn't know what to do with her when they did pick up on it in 2016. So I think it would have been even worse if somebody had tried to refer her back in 2009. But no, basically, she was left just being told, you've got to do better. They did try and sometimes send her to educational courses. And Megan would always say, oh, yes, yes, I'd be really interested. That would be lovely. But she never actually went. She never actually took up the offers. And she would miss a lot of appointments as well. And I would assume that's probably fairly typical, that if you know you're going in and it's all going to be wrong and you're going to get told off, then the chances are you're not going to want to go. She used being a teacher as an excuse quite a lot and would often say, oh, I can't do anything in term time. You'll have to arrange this for holidays, at school holidays. And then she still wouldn't want to, turn up. And the trouble is, what then happens is if you've been referred, there was something called DAFNE, I think, which is to help with education. And she was referred a couple of times, but then the response is, you're wasting our time, so we're going to take you off the list. And you can understand that it must be frustrating, and you want to put the resources, when they're very limited, to the people that appear to be willing to work with you. But nobody seemed to recognise that the person that keeps dropping out is possibly the person in the greatest need. So she was quite often just taken off things. You know, we'll send you up to this higher stage of care. You're not cooperating, you're not responding, we'll take you back off again. So it wasn't until, as we say, this nurse or dietitian picked it up in 2016 and said, I think I need to refer you to an eating disorder clinic. But then again, it's, I'll send you to your GP and I'll ask your GP to send you on to your eating disorder clinic. There didn't seem to be any way, there was no communication between the diabetes people and the eating disorder people to sort of say, here's a person we think you need to see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that sort of disconnect runs right through Megan's history with regard to treatment. I mean, it's very easy to point the finger at this stage because all this stuff we found out retrospectively through the legal process of getting a second inquest into Megan's death. So we have come to this party quite late, but I would say that the sort of disengagement of patients, regardless of what health service they're using, should ought to be a red flag. And there's, you know, and unfortunately, progressively, things got worse and it wasn't picked up. And the referral to eating disorders is a weird one because, you know, this is effectively, it was called the world's most dangerous eating disorder back in 2017 in a BBC documentary. And everything that we've done since points to the lack of diabetic expertise in the integrated care that's required to treat TIDE, which is what it's called now. So, you know, it's been a long journey. We've tried to piece it together in as best way we can. But ultimately, I think we're now getting to a situation 8 years after Megan, to a point where we can actively do something about it. And that is heartening. It's gratifying to see, but it has taken us 8 years. So that gives an indication of how long there has been, in our opinion, mistreatment of this condition. And luckily, that has been validated in our second inquest last year when our coroner agreed with us that the system treating this condition was unfit for purpose. So we now have that validation. And these are not just the views of grieving parents. These are the views of the medical profession as well. So we can bring receipts to every conversation that we have, which has given us an awful lot of confidence and means that we can start kicking back sides and making people do something about this.
Yeah. I think, you know, what you've just explained there, it's, I think, often the piece that's missing in eating disorder treatment or in medical treatment if eating disorders aren't really understood, in the sense of, you know, the way I experience my own eating disorder, and I don't know whether this may be similar for Megan, but the behaviours that I engaged in were a form of self-harm. So, you know, things like the insulin misuse, you know, and that's a form of self-harm. And similarly, you know, and I've said this on the podcast recently, when you work with a dietitian as an eating disorder patient, it's no good them telling you, you know, you need to eat this and you need to eat that, because you know exactly what you need to eat. And I assume it was similar with Megan, you know, she knew she needed to take a medication, but she also knew what would happen if she didn't take a medication. And we know what will happen if we don't eat. And that's the reason people, you know, misuse the medication or they don't eat or what have you. It's because they want those effects to happen. So as you said, Neil, I think that if somebody's not engaging in treatment, maybe they're not taking the medication, they're not turning up to sessions, that's not a cause to say, okay, well, just leave. That's a thing to say, you know, they're actually really struggling and they're struggling to engage, and to dig deeper, you know, why are they struggling to engage? What is going on? You know, how can we help you in this situation? And I'd be really interested, if you don't mind sharing more about the legal inquest that you did, in terms of what did go so wrong or wasn't in place for Megan's treatment, because I think that could be a really good learning example for people that are providing this treatment to say, okay, this is what not to do, and now, you know, this is what we're pushing for in the future.
I mean, the initial, we took part in the internal investigation that happened after Megan's death, and that had to be completed before we could go to inquest. That raised a few points to us. For a start, we suddenly realised, looking through the notes, that nobody had ever actually contacted, nobody in the eating disorder team had ever actually contacted Megan's diabetic team. And Megan had repeatedly, you know, she, as she'd gone through this system, she had repeatedly gone into hospital with something called DKA, which is diabetic ketoacidosis, which is where she was when she was originally diagnosed. And this is when you have not taken your insulin and you have not taken it to such an extent that your body is attacking itself. And it is extremely dangerous. Every time you go into DKA, you could die. And Megan was saying to her eating disorder people, I was in hospital with DKA. Where that should have been an immediate alarm, it absolutely wasn't. They just sort of said, oh, okay, and then carried on. How's your diabetes? And she'd say, fine. And you're like, well, that is an absolute, that's totally impossible. If you've just been in hospital with DKA, your diabetes isn't fine. And so even at that very early stage, as the inquest was arranged, I phoned the coroner's office and said, look, because of what happened, we know that there isn't much in dispute about what happened to Megan in the end. We know it was Megan. We know she did what she wanted to do. Basically, she took her own life by suspension. So there's a lot of things there that don't really need investigating. But what we think is, how she got there,
mm-hmm.
how this treatment that she'd been in for nearly a year had so little effect that she was no better taking the third attempt at her own life than she was at the first. Now, unfortunately, when we got to the actual coroner's office, we hadn't received the correct information, been given any prior information at all. And there were witnesses that couldn't, there was nobody there to ask questions. There were only two witnesses. And the whole thing was very much, well, this is a clear-cut case. You know, we know what happened. We know exactly that it was intentional. And the whole thing took 2 hours. And no exploration took place of why Megan had felt like she did and why this year of treatment had so little effect. And that's why we wanted to sort of move on and say, no, this just isn't right. If things have got to change, we've got to try and get this a bit more out in the open. So that was why we started the process.
I think we started what we considered was a grievance procedure very shortly after Megan's death. We asked to be involved in the formation of that report, making sure that they were aware of what our frustrations were about Megan's treatment. So to get a grossly inadequate inquest after the incident report recognised that there was a lack of integrated services and a lack of diabetic expertise in Megan's treatment, we gave the NHS, the local trust, the opportunity to address those grievances in the 12 months after Megan's death. But after that period of time, we weren't satisfied with what had happened, and we decided to work out what our legal options were. We didn't want to go down the negligence route necessarily, because that wouldn't have addressed the systemic reform that was required to better treat this condition. So we agreed with our legal team that what we would do was challenge the original verdict of the inquest, but with the chances of getting a second inquest. The first inquest was 2 hours. Last year, Megan's inquest was conducted over 10 days. There were two witnesses that my wife mentioned in the first inquest. We had 25 witnesses and 8 statements read out in court. And we worked very, very closely and diligently with our legal team to ensure that there was a proper inquest conducted that we wouldn't have any regrets about after the event. And we could, regardless of what the decision was, we would be able to say, well, at least we tried. And we were so hands-on that the coroner very sympathetically increased the scope of the inquiry to include Megan's diabetic history from the age of 16, to increase the amount of interested persons required to provide statements at and witnesses at the inquest. And we kind of got exactly what we wanted. And although nobody individually was held culpable for what happened, which is not what we wanted anyway, as I say, she did say that the system was unfit for purpose. And because there's no official diagnosis in the DSM or the ICD, this is a very, very difficult condition to get right. Because people tick boxes when patients are assessed, and they sometimes misdiagnose the condition, which means they go down incorrect care pathways because they're the only systems they are aware of. So there's an awful lot that goes into this. But ultimately, throughout that time, our frustration has been about trying to do more on the awareness front while at the same time working through the litigation of this, because it's very difficult to be talking to people who haven't actually provided evidence at a second inquest. The legal process took us 4 years, cost us a lot of money, but ultimately we're doing what our daughter asked us to do, which is to help people she was leaving behind, and therefore it's become a relatively easy thing for us to commit to on that basis.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and, you know, I think from myself and everybody listening, the work that you've done is absolutely incredible. So thank you. And I'm sure, you know, Megan is so grateful for all the work that you're doing as well. And I just wondered if you wanted to maybe speak a bit more about what Megan had said in her suicide letter about what, you know, what her wishes were and what she wanted to change.
Well, it might be easier for me to read a paragraph from that letter, word by word. Megan's overview of her treatment. There needs to be specific inpatient places that take care of insulin doses and meal plans while people receive their therapy. There needs to be mental health support for every newly diagnosed diabetic, whether they had pre-existing problems or not. There needs to be trained nurses who have expertise in both diabetic care and mental health, or at the very least, some communication between those teams. So I think that gives you an indication of Megan's experience, and having witnessed what was probably considered the best community services treatment, outpatient treatment, and also inpatient treatment. She was in the Priory for 3 months, during which she tried to take her life a second time. She considered that things were only going to get worse for her, and she explained it thoroughly enough for us to get to some acceptance of where she was, on the basis that if she carried on, things would have got progressively worse for her. And it doesn't necessarily mean that we agreed with the decision that she took, but we did give us some understanding as to what she felt her future looked like. People had told her that she required years and years of therapy to deal with her condition. And she thought, well, if this is how I'm feeling now, I can't face another 5 to 10 years of people telling me things, A, that I'm already aware of, and B, that aren't going to help. Because she really believed that she knew more about her condition, having researched it thoroughly, than the people talking to her, which once again informs disengagement and means that you don't trust the services that are trying to help you.
I mean, the frightening thing is that when the first time Megan tried to take her own life, she was sectioned. And the place that she went, the secure unit that she went to, did not know how to handle diabetes. So she was actually in more danger almost. Well, in fact, she was in more danger there because she then had to work with a system that wasn't set up for dealing with that kind of condition. It's not a condition where you can have a pill trolley come round at a certain time. You've got to be able to get to the glucose if you need it, the insulin if you need it. You know, she was always put back in the position where, actually, Megan, it'd be better if you do the bit to do with your diabetes. So both there and in the Priory, very quickly, she was in charge of her own insulin control and her own diabetic control. And that sort of proved what we'd always said, that it wasn't that she didn't know how to maintain good diabetic control. We'd always thought that was obvious. You know, she was good at maths. She loved puzzles. She would have been able to work out the best way to deal with her diabetes and how to sort it all out without a moment's hesitation. The problem was, left to herself, she just couldn't do it. Mm. And even when she said, when they were talking about discharging from the diary, she actually said, I won't be able to do this on my own. And she was still discharged and left to do it on her own. And although controls were put in place to try and ensure she didn't take another insulin overdose, nothing was done to make sure that she actually continued to take the insulin as she should do. And I said, that's the problem she went in with. For 10 years, she hadn't been able to take her insulin. She's discharged, and you're doing nothing to address that issue that was the cause of the whole problem in the first place.
Yeah, and I think another important point to mention is that Megan went effectively to an ED unit. And condition itself, someone's BMI doesn't necessarily reflect crisis or emergency. And so risks are high, even with what they would consider would be a normal BMI within a eating disorder unit. And the other aspect of that is that, can you imagine if you're the only person with the condition and you've got an issue with your weight and you are surrounded by anorexics and bulimics who are obviously a lot lighter. So there is the triggering aspect of being put into a situation that doesn't necessarily help somebody with this particular condition. So there's an awful lot going on there. But in fairness to the Priory were one of the only people that did respond to what the coroner's request for preventing future deaths was. And they now include Tide in their diabetic policy and in the relevant policies within the national setup. They have 10 units effective and they've all got this standard policy now. So progress is being made, but it's now kind of our responsibility to make sure that that's done locally with our local trust, with the diabetic service, so that all the dots are joined up now. And as I say, we are making progress on that, but it is incrementally slow. And our frustrations, I suppose, have been hearing stories of other Tide sufferers who have died over the last 8 years when this could have been done some time ago. Because it's strange, actually, when this serious incident report was done by a local trust, they picked up on the point about the lack of integrated services and the lack of diabetic expertise, which was exactly what the coroner said last year. So in that 6-7 year period, the same issues has been raised. So this is why we're working very, very closely with our trust now to ensure that those recommendations are enforced and that the situation hopefully gets resolved very quickly.
We've tried also to, the whole point of the second inquest was to get a thing called a Regulation 28 report, which is where a coroner feels there are things that can be done to prevent future deaths. Now, we got two of those. One went to our local commissioning board because of the lack of an integrated service, and the other one went to the Secretary of State for Health, because obviously that is a wider picture, and that was what we said all along. This is not something. This is the system has to change, the whole system. And so we're trying to get system change from the top, if we possibly can, as well as saying, okay, well, while we're waiting for that, because that's obviously going to be a long process, let's do what we can locally. And I think also the fact the inquest result came out as it did gave us validation, because the last thing we wanted was for people to say, well, that was 8 years ago. So we've now proved that 8 years on, Megan's death in itself didn't change anything. And therefore, we needed to do something more to try and make it change. And I think that's been the sort of motivating factor, that mm-hmm. It's heartbreaking to think that the arguments we were making 8 years ago, we still having to make now.
I find it scary, the sort of lack of awareness about, you know, the way that these things can interweave with each other. And I think what you were saying there about, you know, if somebody that is in quote unquote a healthy BMI, let's say, and they're put on an eating disorder ward, you know, the trauma that can then cause and the impact that can have on people, you know, the comparison and the intensity of behaviours because of that is incredibly difficult. But equally, to put somebody in a ward and, you know, say to them, you know, you're going to have to manage your own diabetes medication. It feels very odd in a hospital setting where, you know, if you think about any other condition, you would think that somebody would therefore, you know, if they were in the hospital, they'd get support for those other conditions that they're struggling with. So, I mean, I'm very, very glad to hear that progress is happening. And I think, you know, it shouldn't take 8 years. But I think as we are seeing with a lot of eating disorder campaigning and mental health campaigning in general, these things, you know, how many people are we going to have to lose before things start to change? But I think that's why the work that you're doing is so important, to make sure that this doesn't keep on happening. And I guess if there's clinicians listening to this podcast, you know, maybe they're diabetes clinicians or eating disorder clinicians, what would you want to be the main thing that they take away from this conversation?
I think when we started to educate ourselves on TIDE, we kind of had to work on a strategy that would make sense, A, to us, and B, to the people at different levels that we're going to be talking to. So, you know, we interacted with politicians, for example, who didn't know the difference between type 1 and type 2 diabetes. So you kind of have to start from a very base level. So we decided to frame it in a way that kind of made sense. And that was to say, if you take eating disorders as primary colour yellow and you take diabetes as primary colour blue, this condition forms a new colour in its green. And you cannot expect to get better outcomes if your siloed information is just in relation to the two separate elements of this condition. So you had to concentrate on the interface and how they interact. So we kind of made this Venn diagram that would show the colours and show the green section in the middle. So we appreciate that services are available. That's why this shouldn't be difficult to piece together, because the resources exist. Now, their effectiveness is up for debate, but the resources exist. So what you're not talking about dealing with a brand new condition effectively. You're talking about a condition that combines multi-morbidities effectively. And that's why just recently we've been working with Hearts Trust on what they call a long-term conditions policy. And that effectively is, as described, would include TIDE, but it also involves so many other conditions like autism and things that tie into other conditions, where the problem is the recognised gap between mental and physical health services within the NHS. So TIDE obviously falls neatly into that. And we're well aware that it wouldn't be on the top of the lists of conditions that people would expect to see in any policy. But what we're trying to make damn sure is that it is included in that. I think diabulimia, by definition, kind of didn't do anybody any favours because it was misleading. Diabulimia, as is, was diabetes non-specific and eating disorder specific, which is opposite to what this condition is. It's unique to a type 1 diabetic, and it involves all forms of disordered eating. And we think that was probably holding it back, because there was this sense that, oh, well, these resources exist, therefore we should be able to know how to treat this condition. And that couldn't be further from the truth. So in answer to that, that's kind of what we've tried to do. And we've decided that what we had to do was connect with all the people involved in those siloed areas and try to have conversations with them initially separately, and then say, look, what you need to do is, if your diabetes TID, for example, or your BEAT, or your Diabetes UK, or your National Centre for Eating Disorders, we understand that you know what this condition is now, but are you talking to the other charities? Are you talking to the other communities? Because you have to have a collaborative conversation where you understand that any advice that you're giving has an impact on the other element of the condition. So if you don't have those joint conversations, you are not going to learn. And because we haven't seen sufficient evidence of learning effectively since 2017, that is our goal, to make sure that at some stage we can walk away knowing that the responsibility for piecing this together is somebody else's. And informing as many people as possible means that we can effectively divest that responsibility to them and say, well, look, we've provided you all the information that you need based on Megan. Megan should have been a catalyst to change. We haven't seen sufficient amount of change. So what are you going to do about it? So all the interested persons invited to our inquest are working with us now constructively. The one probably most in the firing line admitted a few weeks back when I asked her, do you think you'd be having these conversations with us now without Megan's inquest? And she honestly said, probably not. So we do know that us and Megan's circumstances are making a difference, and that's And we know, because we don't fall apart when we talk about Meghan, because it is energizing for us to do so, that we cannot possibly make the situation any worse. So any disappointments, any objections we get to what we're trying to do, we just ignore and we work on what we can change and with people who are invested in helping us and supporting us to make things better.
Yeah, it's talk to one another. Because if you don't talk to one another, you won't realise how conflicting your information that you're providing is. And it's not a case of giving opposite, because eating disorder instructions and diabetes instructions are very different. And in fact, one of the people that has been working quite closely on TRIBE basically said, well, when you give somebody a diagnosis for type 1 diabetes, you give them an instruction manual to get an eating disorder. And that, you know, that is just how wide apart they are. And we've also been trying to get psychiatrists and psychologists on board, because Meghan did go into hospital a lot. She was obviously self-harming by not taking her insulin, which nobody seemed to realise. And because she was intellectually competent, whenever somebody thought maybe they ought to do something, they'd have a very quick chat with her, decide that she was more than able to take care of herself, and didn't realise that because she could answer certain questions and she could remember instructions and parrot them back at you and she could persuade you and argue with you, that actually what she couldn't do was look after herself. So she did a lot to get herself out of being sectioned again, because the idea of going back to somewhere where she felt in danger absolutely terrified her. And nobody seemed to realise that they were missing this one important factor, that she was, in fact, a danger to herself.
Yeah, no, I think capacity is a thorny issue anyway, and its interpretation within the Mental Health Act. And Meghan was only assessed once as not having capacity, and that was after her first suicide attempt. And if you consider in that 11 months that she had a further suicide attempt while an inpatient, and there were many, many opportunities and red flags to assess her differently in relation to the risk with regular DKAs that Leslie mentioned earlier on, there were so many pointers to her spiralling out of control. So we don't believe that the interpretation of the Mental Health Act in relation to Meghan's capacity made any sense. So that's another thing that I would say to any HCP listening, that you need to be very, very careful. You know full well with your eating disorder experience that the body kind of gets used to not getting the right nutrition and not receiving the right insulin. It's very good at that. So even if presentation-wise, your service user, like Meghan, looked okay and was telling people she was okay, there was plenty of evidence to suggest that that wasn't true. So I think, you know, I understand the difficulties with capacity. I understand the difficulties with confidentiality. But there needs to be sufficient evidence that whatever path you choose, and it tends to be one of least resistance, then it has to be evidenced by what's going on physically and mentally with that service user. Because you can't afford to take risks. If the risks are addressed as being high, then you can't afford to just carry on thinking that whatever you're providing is good enough. I mean, talking about that, I mean, we are working with Hope Virgo and Chelsea Roth at the moment with regard eating disorders. We're part of a campaigning group now, which has involved us recently in the Assisted Dying Bill, which exposes the eating disorder community to not having safeguards in place. Meghan would have chosen to take that route if that had been, because she wasn't responding to treatment. They deemed she had capacity and therefore was making her own decision not to eat or take her insulin. And therefore, if that option was offered to Meghan, she would have taken it there and then. So we agree in principle with the assisted dying, but we don't think that there is sufficient safeguards in place to protect the ED community. That's another thing which we're kind of involved in.
And I mean, I can understand Meghan, given that she'd had 11 months, to say, in care, inpatient and in the community, it hadn't worked. All anybody ever said was, when she was trying to disengage and discharge herself, oh, well, we'll leave the door open, you can always come back. Well, why do you want to go back to something when nobody's offering you anything different? Nobody was saying, this isn't working. Nobody even had a conversation with Megan to say, this obviously isn't working, what could we do?
Yeah.
And you think, well, why would you want to go back to more of the same when you know it isn't what you need?
Yeah, I think what you've just said there, I was kind of having a thought process in my brain as you were speaking. And it's a conversation that I had a couple of weeks ago on the podcast with Dr. Anita Federici. And we were talking about the assisted dying bill. And, you know, I said to her, it's a very difficult thing. And I think that, you know, Megan's situation, people could potentially say, well, okay, so you're saying that Megan would accept the assisted dying. Would that not have been better to have that pre-planned or what have you, rather than her taking her own life? My response to that is, well, she shouldn't have been in the position where she wanted to take her own life anyway, because eating disorders are not something that are terminal. Because I've had people message me on the podcast and say, but eating disorders can be terminal. And no, an eating disorder is not a terminal illness. The symptoms that can happen alongside it may mean that you're in a physically compromised state that may, you know, make you very vulnerable. The mental health conditions that go alongside it can lead to suicidal ideation, but in itself, it is not. And therefore, which I think Megan's story, you know, is such a clear indication of this, is the reason that she got to the position that she was and took her own life is because the treatment and the care was not appropriate in order to support her.
It was a response to ineffective treatment that she felt that she'd had the best of. And we know that that's true because she did ask her psychiatrist to provide a tied dossier to take with her to Dignitas. So her healthcare team were well aware of her suicidal ideation. That was a couple of weeks before she took her own life. She took her own life 3 days after being discharged from all services, and they were cognizant of the risks at that particular time. You know, that's kind of what we're railing against. And that's why what you're saying is 100% true. It's difficult enough within the eating disorder community to describe this. But if you add on a layer of type 1 diabetes, I'm not playing top trumps with conditions here, but I'm just saying that it's an extra, it's this constant fight. It's the relationship with your insulin and your diabetes and what they used to call the anorexic voice. So you've got this perfect storm of negativity that kind of feeds into. We've described this condition as mentally persuasive and physically pervasive. You know, that's how we kind of describe it. And those two things constantly at war with each other gave Megan no hope for the future. And that's why she chose what she chose. We kind of have to, A, understand it and B, accept it on those terms, because she did explain it so thoroughly.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, honestly, thank you so much for sharing yours and Megan's story, because I think for, as you just said there, you know, explaining this in an eating sort of context, people might not get. Adding a layer of type 1 diabetes is somebody people really might not get. And I think for the general populace, you know, both of those conditions are hard to understand and comprehend. So thank you so much for sharing your story. I really, really appreciate it. I just wanted to ask, if somebody is listening and they've got a loved one that this is something that they're struggling with, would you have any advice on where they can go or things that they could do?
I mean, we've worked very hard with all the charities. So BEAT, Diabetes UK, Breakthrough TID, and even MIND have information about this condition on their website. Weirdly, we have a relative whose boss mentioned that he now has a child, a young child with type 1 diabetes, and he asked us if he should talk to him about our situation. And we said, no, this only is a problem once you understand what those possible red flags are, to give you an indication of what might be going on. We don't want this to be a scaremongering process, and we don't want it to be confrontation when it doesn't need to be. So the idea is, education and training wise, that there are sufficient people out there who work in various communities that A, understand the condition, and B, can see what those red flags are. And then given that education, that's how you can help people and early intervention as a consequence of that. So no, we don't want to scare people into thinking every time you get a type 1 diagnosis you automatically have an eating disorder, because that's not true. Weirdly, when we started this research, we heard about the propensity for somebody to develop an eating disorder as a consequence of a type 1 diagnosis. Now, that wasn't true in Megan's case. And we believe that you need to be watching for signs of dietary problems. And if a type 1 diagnosis ensues, then you can possibly add the two together and piece together what's going on. But certainly we don't want to be scaring
people. Of course, any young person, the parents are automatically going to be involved in their care anyway. But what I would say is learn as much as you can about how to help in practical ways. Because obviously with type 1, what you're eating is so important. And if you're the parent, you can help, I think, by making sure that you're preparing the food in a way that helps the diabetic cope with what they have to do then. And you can sort of work it out together. And if you do that, then later on, if they need a bit of help, you're in a position to do it. We got no information at all. And I think it would have been really handy to know, you know, what the best foods to do, how foods react with one another, all that sort of thing. Because we had no way of helping Megan in that way.
Sorry, there's one other piece of information that is vital here, and they are the MEAD guidelines, Medical Emergency and Eating Disorders. Annex 3 of those guidelines are TIDE specific. There is a 60-page annex of descriptive terms, how to treat what an MDT looks like in relation to TIDE. It talks about suicide. It talks about all the red flags. So there is plenty of information available now that wasn't available a few years back. But it's interesting to note that during our inquest, those MEAD guidelines had been ignored in existing policy, and they are now nearly 3 years old. So, you know, that's why the ED community needs to be part of this learning process, because the information is available. It's really about its application in existing policy and how that needs to change to reflect what is required to treat TIDE.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's brilliant. Thank you so much. I think the whole education piece is just so important, isn't it, for people with type 1 diabetes, for people that are supporting people, you know, whether that's family, medical professionals, what have you, just understanding, you know, how they can intervene with each other, how it might occur, everything like that. I think that's being able to spot those signs and early intervention really is key. So thank you so much. It's honestly been a pleasure to chat to you both. And yeah, I'm just very, very grateful for you sharing your story.
Well, it's been our pleasure. We really appreciate you giving us the time for this, because it's very important that the word gets out there. Thank you.
If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode. So be sure to subscribe. Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, but with the right support, they can be recovered from. We really hope you enjoyed this episode, but if you require more support right now, please look into charities such as First Steps and Beat for support, or talk to someone you trust.